This is Blair Hodges, host of the Fair Conversations podcast. To learn more about Fair or to make donations, visit fairlds.org. In this episode, Claudia Bushman joins us. Bushman's an American historian specializing in Latter-day Saint women. She holds degrees from Wellesley College, Brigham Young University, and Boston University. Most recently, she served as an adjunct professor at Claremont Graduate University, where her husband, historian Richard Bushman, was chair of the Mormon Studies program. We talk about her personal life experiences in the church and how her and Richard Bushman's relationship has improved both of their publications. Bushman discusses feminism in Mormons, women in the priesthood, and we also explore the unique utility of oral history. Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. All right, we're here with Claudia Bushman. Thanks for joining us, Claudia.
Happy to be here.
First off, I want you to give us a little bit of information about your background, what you've done academically. Just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I went to Wellesley College for my bachelor's degree and studied English literature, and then many years later I managed to get to BYU and work on a master's degree in American literature. And then after that I went to Boston University and studied American and New England studies. In those days we thought all the American studies took place in New England. That's why we have that title. We were always surprised to find out that anything had gone on in the South or in New York or any other place.
Tell me a little bit about what it was like growing up in California as a member of the church.
I figure that I had the ideal church rearing in San Francisco, California. It's just a wonderful time. It was the time when we had all the activities where we were learning to do dramas and speeches and all sorts of things. Spent a lot of time. We learned how to do the tango every year. My father was the bishop. It had one great advantage that anybody who didn't want anything to do with the church just disappeared. We only saw the good, faithful people that came out. It's very easy to disappear if you want to in San Francisco. So I can't tell you enough about it. Of course, it's nostalgia, too. But it was just a very great time. My father was the bishop, and so we were like little princesses in a way, my sisters and I. And while he was in charge of all the administrative things that went on, my mother was kind of the cultural leader of the church, and she was the one who got visions about putting on operettas and choral performances and so on. So we learned a lot of things. I've said often that everything I ever needed to know I learned in church.
Was your dad away often when he was bishop, or was he able to be home quite often?
Well, he was away a great deal. That's the way things were. He was very busy. He had a hard job for his money.
What did he do for a living?
He sold bookkeeping supplies to different businesses. And so he would prepare all the papers that people needed to carry on their businesses, all the personalized things for the companies. So he was very busy doing that. He was also very busy as a church leader. And so it was one of our images of childhood that we sat around the dinner table and the phone on a long cord was brought into Dad, and he would sit and talk on the phone and eat all his meal, and the rest of us would sit there silently as he conducted church business. But we forgave him that.
Now, what are some things about the Young Women's Program that you remember from back then that are missing today?
Well, I remember, as I said, there were the definite areas that we were taught in. The speech, the drama, the music, the dance. I think there was one other one, which I can't remember. But anyway, we had regular lessons in those. And also, at that time, even when I was young and in mutual, I began to realize that they were giving the young men a great deal more attention than they were the young women. And because the program, as it was very appealing to the young women, we gave it no problems at all, but the boys needed extra encouragement. And I remember asking my mother, why do the boys get so much attention? Nobody worries about the girls. And she just told me that that's how it was. Nobody had to worry about the girls. We just had to worry about the men. And so I was prepared for that being the case when I was very young and have observed it in practice ever since.
And eventually you decided to go to school to get higher education. How did you make that decision? Was it something you expected to do for a good part of your life, or was it a rather late decision?
Yes, we were all expected to go to college, and that wasn't true of everybody at that time. And my parents, neither of my parents had gone to college to any degree at all. And I was the first who ever graduated from college on both sides of my family. But it was just assumed that we would go. Not that education was that important to my family, it was just something that we should do. Of course we would do well. We never got rewarded for doing well in school. It was just an expectation. So I was very happy to go to college when it was time.
Did you see it as an opportunity for self-improvement, intelligence-wise, or did you see it as more of an opportunity to get some more culture? How did you view starting out at school?
I saw it as a great adventure, an opportunity to go to new places and meet new people and learn new things. I didn't see myself as a serious student, and still don't.
And let's bring it up to the time you're married Richard Bushman. He's a historian and biographer of Joseph Smith and a distinguished professor of history. How did you two meet each other?
Well, the situation was, and Richard just gave a talk about this, whether it was chance or destiny. And, you know, it was a chance. It could very well not have happened. But he had gone away to Harvard to school. And then he was called on a mission to the New England states, which meant that he was going on a mission in the place he had been. We then met in church in two large old houses that the Longfellow family had owned. One was the mission home, the other one was the chapel. Those were eventually razed, and now we have that new Cambridge chapel that was just rededicated this week after the fire.
Yeah.
So his mission president, whom he had known, and the mission president's wife always called him Dick instead of Elder Bushman, sent him off to Halifax, Nova Scotia, said he didn't want him to be too much involved with his friends. So that's where he went. So he was gone when I came back to school, and I started at Wellesley, which was 12 miles away from Harvard, where he had been going to school. And by accident, neither of us can remember exact circumstances, how he turned up by himself on his mission in this room, dormitory room at Harvard, where I happened to be with some others. But it did happen, and we did meet, and that was the beginning.
Now, I assume, so you weren't, were you quite yet a serious student? You said you still aren't a serious student. Were you still having some fun at school or when Richard came around? Because I assume, was he more of a serious student than you were?
He was much more serious than I was. But I tried to be serious from time to time. It just is too much work, you know. It's a very big job to be a serious student.
Did you finish your degree after you were married or before?
After. We were married after he graduated from college and after I finished my junior year. Then I completed my last year of college.
Was that unusual? Did you know many LDS couples back then who both were pursuing higher education?
No, I don't remember any couple where both of them were in school at the same time then. But there were a number of people who were getting married at that point. I mean, after their junior years, people tended to be married around 20 or 21 or 22. They didn't wait a long time. So it wasn't that unusual.
Now, there was a point when you moved to Delaware or were in the Delaware area, is that right?
Yes, but that's a long time after we were married. And when was that? When did we go to Delaware?
1977.
So it was a while later.
Yeah, we were married in 55.
Okay.
So that's 20 years.
So you were in Boston before that?
We were in Boston. We stayed in Boston after we were married. And within a year out in England. And then we came back and Richard finished his degree.
This summer is the 40th anniversary of the dialogue Pink Issue. People called it, you know, the Pink Dialogue. It's a landmark publication in the reemergence of a feminist mentality amongst Mormons, especially regarding church history and women's issues. So the story's been told a lot in a lot of different places, so people can go and look that up. But maybe you could briefly just give us an idea of how that publication came about. There was a group you were meeting with and sort of led to this.
Yes. In Boston, in those days, we had many interesting couples, very smart young men who were working on advanced degrees, and their equally smart wives who were very much underemployed, home with young children and doing all the things that entailed, but still had ambitions or abilities to work hard. And one of the first projects that they did was a guidebook to Boston called The Beginner's Boston, which was really a marvelous thing that Laurel Thatcher Ulrich did with illustrations by Person, now known as Carolyn Person, who is John Durham Peter's grandmother. In any case, this was a situation, an idea that came to our bishop, who was Bert Van Eidert at that time. And he met with a number of men, young men who were studying at the Harvard Business School, and said, I've looked at the market, I think that the city of Boston could use another first-rate guidebook, and I'd like you to study it and see if you think this is a feasible project. And they looked over the project and they decided, no, it was not feasible, it would just be too much work. And the Relief Society president, who was Bonnie Horn, said, the women will do it. And that was the first publication that they did, and it was a great success, and used the skills of many, many women. It was really a marvelous event. So we came back to Boston about the time that after that had been published, actually, and then Laurel moved away soon after, and I edited and brought up to date the second edition of that book. But we continued to meet, or the women sort of continued to meet as a group, to talk about our lives as Mormon women, because there were a lot of what were called consciousness-raising groups at that time, where you would get together and just pour out your heart and weep and wail and so on about our lost and messy lives. And we did that, and it was a group of maybe 15, 17, 20 people that would come about once a month, and we would have these discussions. And it was a very strenuous time, because there was so much feeling that was expressed, and people would go home with headaches, there would be tears, there would be all sorts of things. And it really did occur to me that we were wasting a lot of energy, and if we could just find some good projects, we could work together and have something to show for it, and it would be much more harmonious and satisfying. So one time Jean England was visiting with us, and I remember we were walking in the Harvard yard for some reason. I'd been planning to make this pitch to him and say...
He was with Dialogue at the time, right?
He was one of the founding editors along with Wes Johnson. And I said, Gina, we've got this group of women here that are very smart, very able. I wonder what you'd think if we did an issue of Dialogue, a women's issue. He, without a no pause, he said, great idea, go ahead. You know, he was always very welcoming and open, and it's one of his great, great attributes. Anyway, so it took us a long time. None of us had ever done anything like it. But we did create the Pink Issue, and it's got a lot of good stuff in it.
Were most of the contributors to that issue in the area, or was there a lot of correspondence that you had to go with, letters and phone? Because today we just email each other. Mm-hmm. So how did you negotiate the conversation?
Well, we put an ad in Dialogue and said that this was an issue for the silent majority, and then we had a lot of friends in various places, and we would solicit articles and ask who else they knew, and we had our own people write things, and they refused to do it, and we'd find someone else. You know, it was a lot of negotiation back and forth, and then there was a huge amount of editing, but when it came out, it really was a sensation. It was not because it was so great, although it is pretty good. It's got a lot of good things in it, but that a group of women should do such a thing. Just amazing that, which really seems like a very simple thing, and there was no question that the people were able to do it, but still that they should do it was considered revolutionary.
Had you done much work on Mormonism before that, or was that sort of a turning point maybe the first project that you'd worked on that was really focused in on Mormonism?
I think it was a first for me, pretty much. I can't remember if I had already... I interviewed my father for an article in Dialogue, which was published on the Sunset Ward. But that was in that early period, too. But no, I hadn't thought of myself in any way as a historian of Mormonism. The way we were taught in church, we said, yes, that's how it is. We didn't ask questions. We didn't delve deeply into the volumes about things. We just sort of took what was offered. But it was really a revelation to me to see that we could do a publication really on any subject, that we could do anything, and we proceeded to do many things.
Can you think of some ways that project has affected the trajectory of your work on Mormonism since then? Are there things that you learned in that process that you've carried through?
Yes, there are certainly things that are characteristic of my projects in that I like to have a group of Mormon women to work with. There's no group that's better. And as we worked together on those, that and then went on to do Exponent 2 and Mormon Sisters and our Exponent Day dinners and every kind of other project we could think of at the time, it was just so evident that working together, we had all the talents that were required. And it's so good for us to work together. We develop those skills. We come to love each other in ways we never would otherwise. So I still feel myself working very much the same way.
In an interview that you gave just a little while ago, you mentioned that perhaps the number one lesson that you took away from that experience was the need for people to write, the need for people mm-hmm. to express themselves, to keep a record, which to me, when you think about it, looking back, there seems to be a very Mormon thing to do. When you read through the Book of Mormon, there's this continuing theme calling people to write this down, and that there's something sacred about that. So we're going to talk about oral history at the end of this interview and talk about some of those, that element of Mormonism of keeping records. But before we move on to that, I also want to talk about your time in New York. When did you and Richard move to New York?
When did we move to New York, Richard?
1989,
that's right. We went to New York right after Delaware. And
ooh, Delaware. Yeah. Joe Biden?
Absolutely. He's a friend of mine.
Let's hear it.
I was doing in Delaware, and I've said many times, and I definitely believe it, that when there's a move in a family, the men move from something to something. But the women, certainly the women then, move from something to nothing. And you have to create a new life. And that's really a kind of a hard thing to do. And it was certainly true for me when I moved to Delaware. However, I did fall into some very interesting things. And one of the ways that this happened was I became a local historian. I was really a female historian, an American studies person, but I decided I would teach a class on my little town, which was Newark, Delaware, which everyone agreed had no history, even though there is a school there where three signers of the Declaration of Independence attended and lots of other significant things. So I used it as coffee table, cocktail party conversation for quite a while. I said, why is there no historical society in Delaware, in Newark, when we have them in several other places in Delaware? And people would say, oh, there's no history there. I would counter, yes, indeed, there is history. And finally, we put together a kind of a little consortium. Some of my students, the town planner who had a PhD in history, the wife of a developer, two or three of the significant historians of Delaware who all lived there and taught at the university. And we started a historical society. And it was very much the kind of thing I'd done with the women in Boston. We did projects. We did all kinds of projects. And some of them were really sensational, if I do say so myself.
What's the most sensational one?
Well,
or I'll give us a sensational one.
Oh, gosh, we did lots of great stuff. Well, for instance, we had a series of old photographs of the city that had been done about 50 years before. And these were done for a painter who needed to do a border for murals we won't go into. So we re-photographed those places and put that up as an exhibition and republished the one little history of the town in connection with that. And we did all these things in connection with. Anyway, but from that, I got an offer of a job, which was working for the Delaware Heritage Commission, which is the group that celebrates things in Delaware. It's a political organization, but meant to be balanced. And during the time, I did this part-time at first, and then I took it on full-time. And during that time, we celebrated the creation of the Constitution. A very big deal in Delaware, because Delaware is the first state to ratify the Constitution. And there are lots of good reasons why that is so. It's close to Philadelphia, but also because they were great big winners in the ratification, in the representation compromise, because they have equal representation in the Senate when they're so. Anyway, so for several years there, I went up and down the state doing everything we could think of to do to celebrate this occasion. And you don't want to hear all those things. They aren't Mormon. But we sure had a great time. We had the biggest parade that ever took place in the state. We had.
You knew Joe Biden somehow. How did that happen?
We knew all the people. I mean, this, in Delaware, another of its great opportunities is that it's so close to Washington D.C. that all the congressional delegation, what do? They commute. They take the train down to Washington. They come back at night. So anybody that wants to know them, that has any interest in knowing them, can easily get acquainted with them. And I had many reasons to work with their offices, and I knew all those people. I knew the governor. I knew him pretty well. He didn't like me very much, but we got along.
Joe didn't?
No, Joe was always nice to me.
The governor didn't?
The governor didn't.
You were a troublemaker?
This was a very political situation. I won't go into all of that, but I couldn't, when I started this, I couldn't read the politics nearly as well as I can now. And so I did some things thinking I was doing the right thing when others were upset. But the Chief Justice, we did all kinds of wonderful events for that.
So after that, you and Richard ended up in New York
City.
Then
we went to New York.
Manhattan is where
Manhattan.
You went? And that's because Richard got a job. Is that when he got a job with Columbia? Is that?
That's right. And we moved to a Columbia apartment.
Okay. And there you also got involved with quite a few different civic projects as well. Is that right? For example, a living nativity scene. There was a reenactment of the sailing of the ship Brooklyn. I guess that was more of a Mormon event.
These are all Mormon events. That's pretty much what I did there was Mormon events. And the statue of Joseph Smith, that was certainly a Mormon event.
It's said that you worked in church public affairs at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? What kind of work did you do for that?
Well, put on all those kind of things for one thing, and then go visit lots of groups. And then the big job I had in public affairs was as chairman of the Bridge Builders, the Harlem Bridge Builders Committee, which means that they were sending me and the committee to Harlem to make friends, because you may not remember, but there was a very unfortunate situation when the church bought a very significant building, a corner on a major street, to build a chapel. And this was a building that had been condemned. And they bought it with the understanding that it would be knocked down. However, when they went through the various efforts to get the permissions, they discovered there was someone who was buying electricity in that building, a squatter, and he refused to leave. And that was a very messy situation, because after trying all kinds of things to get him out, they stalked him, they locked him out, and they knocked the building down. And then he went to the papers and all the politicians and made a big fuss. And he's still what does he do? He
pickets.
He still pickets our chapels.
To this day?
To this day.
That is, that you got to admire that sort of commitment.
Well, you do. And, of course, in New York, people think squatters have some rights. You know, they aren't just nobody. They're there, and they have a right to a place to live. So he had a lot of friends. So we spent quite a bit of time trying to overcome the prejudice that people had against that church full of tall, blonde guys with big smiles and so on. That was as mind-opening an experience as we had. Yes, it was really just a tremendous opportunity and very enlightening, because we lived quite close to Harlem, but it was that we lived up on Morningside Heights. Harlem is just down below, and it's walking distance, but it is a different world. So,
yeah, I had never heard about that. A couple of things you did also sounded really interesting. You produced the Mormon Oratorio Chorus concert at Carnegie Hall. How was that? Was that pretty neat to...
It was sensational. So I've sung on the stage of Carnegie Hall. How about that?
Yeah, that's great. And also the Temple Youth Jubilee in Radio City Music Hall as well you were involved with.
That's right.
Do you remember about how many, was it primary kids that were?
No, these were mutual kids.
So older.
We had 2,500 on the stage at Radio City Music Hall. It was our Temple Jubilee, as you said. And when we started out, Richard and I were both on the Temple Committee, and it didn't look, they had just started having these jubilees, and it didn't look like we would be doing one, but then we got the assignment to do it.
What was the Temple Jubilee?
Well, it's a big event where the young people of the church sing and dance and wear costumes and maybe reenact the history of the place they're dealing with. And it's just one of the side events that goes with the temple dedication these days.
Which dedication was it?
This was the Manhattan Temple.
Okay.
And so... After I spent some time trying to find a venue, a place we could put this thing on, and it looked like anything would cost $1 million, because everything costs a lot in the city, and you're going to get Shea Stadium, you're going to get...
The Beatles played there.
Going to get a place in Central Park. Anyway, it was very expensive. So then it looked like we wouldn't have it. But then Dave Checkett said that he thought he could get Radio City Music Hall, which he did. And as you know, he was president of Madison Square Garden, and which also owned Radio City Music Hall. And it's a very significant theater, but it's also old-fashioned and very hard to deal with. For one thing, getting on and off that stage is just the dickens. And yet we had a team, you know, volunteers came under the wall. I mean, it was just a wonderful bunch of people. We figured out how to put on that show. So we had to have 7 different acts get on and off that stage. And we had a little narrow staircase. It was very difficult. But we had one of men of our history committee, Scott Tiffany, went to all the different places and filmed the kids practicing and interviewed them and interviewed members of the 12 apostles who had lived in the area and, you know, just put together these little vignettes which we showed on 2 great big screens in between, gave us enough time to get on and off, made our show tight. I mean, considering the problems of doing a show there, it was just an amazing success. One thing, for instance, the marquee is not a nice modern one. You have to put up every letter by itself. It costs $1,000 to change that marquee. Could we afford the $1,000 to change the marquee for our show? And we could only be in that building one day, so it isn't as if we could put things up long in advance. But so we finally decided that we'd better do it. And we And so I worked out something for it to say, Mormon Temple Youth Jubilee, Manhattan, you know, all the kinds of things, got it all on, and we did it. And because we didn't want it to be the next rock concert that was there when our people got there. And that was what President Hinckley saw when he got out of his cab to come to this jubilee. He was really thrilled by that.
Did he get to meet the committee that put it on at all?
Oh, no. They never meet the underlings, only the top guys. But anyway, he did say at the end, he said, and it was worth it every penny. And we all know he is very tight with his money. And it was a good show. It was amazing that we could do it. When we started working on it, the people who were in the professional people who we had to pay said, there's no way in the world you can put on a show like this with volunteer labor. But of course, we did it. And we had just that one day in the theater, and they had to load in all the equipment first. They had to bring everything from far off and load it in. And then, so we had time to go through the show about once and a half. It had been practiced in different places all over the area. All these people came in buses. I mean, it was just a logistical nightmare. And yet, it worked. We did it. So that's more than you want to know about.
No, that's great. Around in 2002, you were honored as New York's Mother of the Year. How did that come about?
Well, it's been an organization, American Mothers, that has had a lot of Mormon connection over the years. And the representative in New York just asked me if I would represent New York for that. And what they want is somebody that has, here you're supposed to be honoring the mother, but what they really want is community, church, and academic achievement, those three things as well as the others. And so I thought they could make a case for me in those three areas. Anyway, they did. I was the New York Mother of the Year.
How many children do you have?
I have 6.
And how many grandchildren?
20.
Do you have any great-grandchildren yet?
Not yet. No marriages yet in that bunch.
It's pretty big posterity. I guess you had you saw a lot of them just recently for the
yes.
For Richard's...
we had this reunion.
And then Richard was named the chair of Mormon studies at Claremont, right?
Mm-hmm.
How many years? It was in 2008. So in 2008, Richard gets a position at Claremont, and you also were taken on to teach courses as well, right?
That's right. I taught as an adjunct. It was a great opportunity for us to expand the offerings in Mormon studies, and I was very glad to be in on it.
What courses did you teach?
Well, I started out teaching Mormonism through the eyes of women, and then I proceeded to teach that stuff over and over with different names. Mormon women in the 19th century, Mormon women in the 20th century, Mormon literature of Mormon women, and we just kept reading different things for everything. But I also taught a class on autobiographies, which had no Mormons in it at all. And so all of these classes had some non-Mormons in them, and the autobiographies class had more than usual. But so we got to know a lot of the women involved in the Claremont programs pretty well.
How was the ward there compared to, say, a ward in New York where you were?
Well, we were in the Pasadena ward, which is one of the fabled old wards, which was one of the real winners. And in the past, they could do everything, and they had more talent than you could shake a stick at. And now it's really peaked a little bit, but it still has wonderful older people, has lots of wonderful younger people, but they can't afford to buy in. So we have young people that come and start their careers there, along with mature, older people. It's wonderful for us to have some people that aren't just law students, which is what our ward in New York is mostly made up of.
So it was a good change?
Yeah. We love the ward. There are lots of people we really, really like in that ward. It's a great place.
The next subject I want to bring up is something that you've referred to, tongue-in-cheek, as the F word, feminism. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk a little bit about your definition of feminism, because it seems to be a little different than what some people might expect.
Yeah. I think as soon as you bring up the war between the genders, you've already lost the war. You know, and I don't even use the F word, because it is so polarizing for the women in the church. There's so many that feel they must defend to the death their refusal to be feminists, even if they act like feminists in many ways. So my definition of feminism is that the talents of women should be developed for the benefit of themselves, their families, the church, and the community. And I think that's really all that's required. And everybody's talents should be developed.
Back in 2003, you said that you felt like feminism is dead or dying with our generation. Now, I take it that you didn't mean by that that ideas about equality or the place of women in the church or that or those sort of things were just going away, but that something was changing at that time. Why did you say that feminism was dying at that time?
Well, I don't really like to see this war fought, as I said. So I would just assume we didn't talk about feminism anymore. I think we talk about things that we do. We plan projects. We work together. And we do the things that feminism means to me, but we don't talk about it because it just is very threatening to the church as a whole, to the leaders, and to a lot of the other women, as I say. So I just don't think we make any progress when we do that. So I was hoping that the old debates were dying, and I really think they had been. I mean, feminists went underground to quite an extent after excommunications and various other difficulties. So I thought it was possible, but it just keeps coming back. So I guess there's no point in really taking that stand. It just keeps coming back.
There's a Mormon author by the name of Catherine Soper, and she pointed out that feminists challenge male authority, whereas Mormons defer to male authority in the priesthood. And you agreed with that, and you said, I prefer stealth progress to confrontation. What sort of stealth progress were you referring to? What kind of things?
Well, I say things like now I see that women are included more in the ward councils, and that the ward councils are taking precedence over even the priesthood executive committee, which is mostly men. I see women being moved into positions of power and authority to a limited degree in the church, and that's what I like to see. Now, if we have wars, that will never happen. And what will happen? The women have no weapons to fight that war. They just leave the church, and I don't like to see that happen. So I say, let's just try and do what we can.
You made another interesting comment about you felt very free during the time when the pink issue of dialogue was being put together, and that things today do feel a little bit different than that for Mormon women. I hope you can talk a little bit about how things may have changed for Mormon women over the past few decades.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we were doing all those projects in Boston, nobody really expected them to happen, and it took quite a while for them to respond. They did respond. They were against it, but while that didn't happen, we were really free, free as can be. We just did everything we could think of, and we thought of a lot of good things. And it's true, people would send anonymous letters to Salt Lake and complain about us in lots of ways, but it's true, various things happened. But in those days, we didn't feel that there was a structure that had already been set up to say you cannot do these things, because nobody thought about it. Now there are those things, and we have a very strong statement that we're not supposed to pray to Mother in Heaven. That's one of the major feminist possibilities, is to develop a relationship with the Mother in Heaven. And now we have President Packer, who's come out and said, you know, that feminists and intellectuals and others are a threat to the church and so on, you know, things like that. So I think you do have to watch your step, but I think it's very unfortunate that that is the case. Women are so willing to do all kinds of things, and if they were just encouraged a little bit, they could be lots more beneficial to wards and stakes than they are now.
And I think a lot of women, for example, in my home ward, we have, you know, a lot of women working in the primary. They really carry the load there. They do a lot there. We have women who have positions in the Relief Society, women who have various callings. What do you think, aside from those sort of institutional opportunities, that that Mormon women can do to find a little bit more fulfillment through church activity?
Well, I would like to see them represent the church in lots of civic organizations. They should be encouraged to run for the school board. They should be invited to represent the church, or at least themselves, in neighborhood block organizations. They should be part of the community. I think it's really just terrible that we have so few people that are involved in community activities, because we are so involved in doing largely busy work at church. And there still aren't enough good jobs for women in the church. They need something else like that. So I'd say there's room for that sort of thing. There's room for more cultural activities. I'd like to see people that in the public relations spheres that are assigned to become friends with other congregations, of other churches, I mean, and try to do some kind of joint activities with them. I know in the oral histories we've had a number of people that have talked of such things, where they collaborate on blood drives and sewing charitable projects and lunch, you know, situations where they serve people meals. And I mean, they're just this. We just have to see a larger platform for work. That's all I'd see.
I think the scripture that comes to mind, I don't remember exactly which section it is. I'm going to say section 58, maybe, where basically Joseph Smith is saying, the Lord says, do many things of your own
free will and choice.
And it sort of feels like you hope that people would take that verse and sort of run with it.
Mm-hmm.
What have you learned over time about being an effective a woman in the church who can draw other women to her and sort of get those projects working? What are some of the failures and successes either that you've seen throughout the past several decades? You mentioned Mother in Heaven, where we're encouraged not to pray to her, for example. You also mentioned ways that women can become involved in the community. What are some failures and or successes that you've seen women be able to accomplish throughout the past few decades that are encouraging or discouraging? I don't want to direct mm-hmm. it either way. I sort of want to see where you'd like to take that.
Well, I would say, here's an example of the way I think women work together pretty well. When we came to Pasadena 10 years ago, 12 years, 14, however long ago it was, I had a couple of people to visit teach. And one of them was a very talented string player, and I said, I'll produce a concert for you. And so I then asked the people that visited me and the other people I visited to be on my committee, my best friends and so on. We all worked together on that project. We put on this event, and you know, she could have done it herself, but it would have been a lot harder for her. But that was inside but outside the church thing. It was using people that we were connected to by some official connection, but to do something that they didn't, that was of our own free will and choice. And so that's one kind of a thing that I see. And the other thing, for me, I get these, what I call my revelations, and I get an idea of something that should be done. And then I just go about asking people to help me. And there's just no better group of people than the Mormons to work on it with you. And so, you know, that really is good for them. It's good for all of us.
Now, since 2003, since you hope that maybe feminism was going away, there's also been sort of a resurgence since then of Mormon women who do like to call themselves feminists. And there's a whole spectrum of people, of women especially, who are interested in feminist issues and talking about feminism. Do you have any suggestions for maybe improving the dialogue amongst Mormons who might have different views of feminism? What are some suggestions for facilitating maybe a more productive dialogue between people who might even disagree on the role that feminism should play in the church?
Well, not making feminism the real central thing, but at Claremont, for instance, I would have, say, a few people that were really legitimate students, and then I would recruit a bunch of other people that would come to class, and some of them turned into students and some didn't. But I think if they would read the texts, most of which people that aren't in our business don't even know exist, then the discussions will come. They're just great books that should be everybody should know about, but because they're not published by Deseret Book or because they're not scriptures, they don't get read, people don't know what's in them. So it's very enlightening for people to talk about the church in ways that are not Sunday school talk, but in ways that are academic. And that's what I feel we accomplished at Claremont and really enjoyed. There are a number of women, as I say, that have gotten deeply involved but have not been registered for things, for classes. And they are working now they've worked on projects, presentations at conferences, papers coming from the oral histories. We're now working on a book, I hope, where everyone is writing an essay, and these women are just part of it. They have become scholars on LDS female materials. I just think it's wonderful for them. So,
now this next question is sort of more personal and theological, I would say. The question I have is, when we think about the church as being God's church, that the prophets receive revelation for the church and to help guide even day-to-day activities, maybe even committees and things like that. Have you ever had the feeling that maybe you wish there was a section of the Doctrine and Covenants that just said, you know, make women more prominent in the church or something like that? And if you have felt like that, how do you reconcile that with your view of God revealing things to church leaders? Is that hard to reconcile at all?
Well, I just figure women have equal access to revelation with men. I take section 25, which was the one given from Joseph Smith through Joseph Smith to Emma in 1830, where it talks about all sorts of things that women can do. They can exhort the congregation, they can expound the scriptures, they can do specific tasks, they can do bigger tasks, and it says at the end, and this shall be direction for all. And I think if you take that in 1830, and then if you take the Relief Society minutes from 1842 when it was founded, which are now available online with the Joseph Smith papers, and you see what Joseph Smith is promising the women of the Relief Society at that time in his early talks, you know, that's plenty. I don't think we work anywhere near where we could. You know, women have gotten in the habit of thinking, no, I can't do that unless I'm asked. But there's lots of space. There's lots of space and room for women to work in. And I just want to encourage that as much as I can.
You mentioned the early Relief Society minutes, and people who might not be so familiar with the history of the Relief Society might be interested to know that after the martyrdom of Joseph Smith, the Relief Society sort of went on hiatus, basically. I believe it was Brigham Young who I put the kibosh on it, for lack of better words, to say we're going to hold off on that for a time. But then the Relief Society was eventually brought back a little bit later in the 1800s. And so I want to sort of segue into some discussion about the Mormon history and the Relief Society. What are your thoughts on that historical time period when the Relief Society was brought back to the church?
68. Well, I think it was very interesting. Eliza R. Snow, who was, of course, Brigham Young's wife at this time, was also set apart or told to go off and organize the Relief Society and all of the wards of and stakes of the church, and she did that very successfully. The Women's Exponent has many of her talks, the things she talked about in the different wards, printed. And so this is a time when, as you mentioned before somewhere, the women are both freer and more constricted than at other times. Many of them are married in polygamy, and so they are definitely under the direction of their husbands. But on the other hand, the Relief Society members act quite freely in doing projects that they define for themselves or are assigned to them, you know, the silk making, the wheat gathering, the community stores, all this sort of thing. They work together as groups. They work in organizations in the wards. And so I think it's a very fulfilling time for the women even though they are in these polygamous unions. They really...
I think there was also an interesting transition period, especially following the manifesto, which declared an end to polygamy on behalf of the institutional church. And you've recently published a book, which is an autobiography of your grandmother. And she had a few funny things to say about polygamy. So there, she came just after, a couple of years after they had sort of stopped everything. And maybe you can talk a little bit, if you remember, about some of the feelings that she had about Mormons. She wasn't born in the church. And so mm-hmm. she had ideas about polygamy.
Well, this is my grandmother, Margaret Elizabeth Shute Gordon, who was born in 1866 and died in 1966. So she saw a lot of church, and she was baptized when she was in her late teens. And so she says at one point that an important polygamist proposed to her, and she told him, to go to hell, which I can imagine not quite my grandmother saying. And she also said that when she was first stirred to study the church, she tried to escape from these feelings because she felt that Brigham Young was an evil man, and for this reason of polygamy. And but she became a very faithful member of the church, as you know, and... this autobiography that she wrote is just a miracle to me because I didn't know it existed. None of her other descendants knew it existed. We all knew that she'd written a short sketch, which is a very public document. But here is a much more extensive autobiography, which I think is just a marvelous literary gem, beautifully written, full of interest, and tells a lot about a woman in the church at that time.
So. Yeah, it was really well edited. I mean, your grandma had some amazing experiences working as young when her father was a missionary for, I believe it was an Anglican mm-hmm. church, and they moved to Alaska, and they dealt with Inuit, you know.
Tsimshian Indians, T-S-H. Something like that.
And she yes. has some very beautiful passages in there about mm-hmm. the... about how it was to live there and be with the people there. I mean, the book, very engaging. It was found in an archive, right?
Well, the thing is, I put it there. When my mother died, I collected up all her papers and her mother's papers, which were there, and put them, wrote introductions, put them in, and it was part of that. But I didn't conceive of it. And it was years later that I discovered it by accident, so it's... was just a miracle to me.
You're your own Moroni, really. You,
that's
you deposited
right.
it in the box and you removed the stone.
And it might have very well disappeared if I had not deposited it in the box.
Yes. So. I think that's really cool. And this just brings us right to the topic of books. You've written several. Do you have a favorite that you've written that you really enjoyed writing and that you're more particularly proud of as a great accomplishment?
Well, I'm quite proud of Mormon Sisters because it was one of the things that Boston group did. And I think that it still stands as a very significant book for understand with Mormon Sisters, Women in Early Utah. A lot of people tell me that's their favorite book, and that's pretty good. But I also love all my old books because it's like a mother with her many children, and I like A Good Poor Man's Wife, which is the story of Harriet Hanson Robinson, who has really been my mentor, along with my husband Richard, over the years. She lived a life that she could really be proud of and was very influential for me. But I like all my books, as I said, and I like the one about John Walker, which is in old Virginia, a slave-owning farmer. And I wrote that out of his journals. And I now know things about Southern farming I never even thought of asking. So I enjoyed that. But I like all my books.
Now, you and Richard are known to collaborate a little bit on some of the work that you do. It's a really cool relationship that you guys sort of have this ability to work together that way. What has Richard brought to your work?
Well, he reads everything I write and makes it make sense, which is, you know, I say the line is, he tells me what I really think. He's horrified by that statement, but that is what he does. that we started really collaborating on those books for Oxford University Press. What are they called? One is Building the Kingdom and one is something else. Actually, he was asked to write those books, but he was too busy. He didn't want to do it. I said, look, we can do it. We can do it together. You write the beginning part and I'll write the end part. And that's what we did. And I think it actually worked pretty well.
It's a very underrated book. I think Building the Kingdom is. It's a very good book.
Yeah.
It's a one-volume quick read that you can recommend to friends who aren't members of the church or to friends mm-hmm. who are and haven't really been too interested in history. It's a very good primer, I think.
Plus, it has pictures you've never seen before, doesn't it?
It did.
Yeah. Anyway, yes, it's got... And it's good to write short books. Short books have real benefits sometimes.
Now, when I interviewed Richard, I asked him about ways that you've helped him. And he said that you're very good at helping him improve his prose and helping him put together better sentences and tightening things up. Is that...
Well, yes, he says that, and I guess that's true. There are some of his idiosyncrasies I just really don't like. So I take them out.
One? Can you think of one?
Oh, he has problems with agreement. He talks about bits of things. There's just several usages I don't like. And so
bits?
You don't find them in his
works
anymore. Just a little bit simple-minded or something, you know, that kind of way. But no, he really writes very well, and he has, of course, many much better ideas than I do. He has excellent ideas.
He points to your intuition, your sense of being able to quickly, early on grasping ideas, and then you sort mm-hmm. of bounce these off of each other.
Well, it's been very fortuitous for both of us that we're in the same business. And, you know, he is the great one. I'm just the little servant girl, but but it has been very beneficial to both of us.
Was there anything you run into when you're collaborating on a book about Mormonism that you still might disagree on? Is there anything like that that you and Richard have had, perhaps in history or in a book you've written, where you still might say, I see it differently than that?
Well, I think the role of women has been a significant issue for us. And Richard realized that I felt differently than some people about the role of women in the church. But he just could not believe for a long time that I wasn't just the exception, that I was just, I was unusual. Nobody else felt that way. Now I think he tries very hard to be understanding of such positions and to agree that lots of women do feel that way.
Fair enough.
He will say that. So,
I think I might have mentioned this at the beginning of the podcast, but you've pointed to a gap between institutional history of the church and women's history in the church, and that I think... Part of that is just due to our leadership-centric chronology, for lack of a better way to put it, where we tell the history of the church through a succession of prophets and through a mm-hmm. succession of leadership and perhaps administrative decisions and organizations. And so, especially with the rise of the correlation movement through the 60s, you saw kind of a decrease in, I'm ashamed to say it, but I probably can't name seven Relief Society presidents of our history. You know, even right now. So there's this gap there, and it goes not only from the top, but all the way to the regular members of the church when we get into the stories that regular members of the church might tell. The reason I bring this up is because you've started an initiative at Claremont, a women's oral history project, and I get the impression that's one of the reasons you did that, is to fill that gap. Is that accurate?
That's right. I think, my original feeling is we're told to do genealogy. But my heretical view is that after three generations, the records, there is such a good chance of you making mistakes that there's not much point in going far back. But what you should do is do the genealogy, the stories of the people who are still alive. They won't be alive forever. And you can get things firsthand that are so much richer and better than if you try and write the story of your grandmother or your grandfather. If you can get something in someone's own words, it's just a great treasure. And so we see this oral history as our gift to the future. For now, we keep it closed. except to those who are our students and our friends. They're using it for publications and for presentations and theses and dissertations. But eventually we'll put it into several depositories where it will be available to people in the future. And it's just a wonderful collection. I cannot tell you how thrilling some of these stories are to me. They're just wonderful.
The last tally that I saw, and this was a while ago, was that you guys were up to about 65 or so interviews, and you'd projected to do 100 by the time you had a conference, I think, with Sister Okazaki.
Who was unable to come because she was ill.
I was going to ask if she made it or not.
Aileen Clyde and her granddaughter, Emily Clyde Curtis, were our speakers. But we had, by the time of the conference, we had over 100, and we now have 130, which is a lot.
How long are they usually, the interviews? I assume that you have a student sit down with them and just go over a series of questions for a period of time?
Yes, we do that, but we also have people write their own if we have nobody that's around to do that, to interview them. And so they range from, we have some that are probably 15 pages, single space. They go up, I think, 40 pages. They're extensive, and they are signed, and they are dated.
You said no anonymity. You wanted people to put their name to it.
Yes, but we're still using them anonymously for now.
But as mm-hmm. far as for record purposes?
For record purposes, we do not take anonymous ones. We just don't do it. We do not promise their names will never be used.
You said they're going to be housed in several different places. Are they just housed at Claremont right now?
They're just housed on our own website. So the university doesn't have them, just we do. But they probably will go to Claremont. They'll probably go to BYU Special Collections, and they'll probably go to the church archives, maybe to other places too. Our aim at the moment is 200. And we are also going international. We're trying to get more and more members of the church who are not on the North American continent. And that's going pretty well. It's going pretty well.
Now, as a historian, it's really interesting to think, to ask you about the difference between oral history and some other ways that we can access the past. Because there are some interesting differences that can come up. And traditionally, oral history has been used to tell the stories of more marginalized people, maybe people who were illiterate or people who didn't have access to, you know, or time to write out their life stories, or maybe didn't think about it. They had to be approached to do it. So with oral history, what are some of the strengths with oral history? Because in the church, we sort of have a very charta-centric or very, you know, paper-centric history writing, where we go in the archives, we've got it all written down. Oral history, it's a little bit different than that, even though you do make them into transcripts. What shines in an oral history that you're probably not going to get in something that was originally created as a written document?
As members of the church, we tend to be told to write faith-promoting stories. And we know what those are like. But what we get from these is franker documents. We get people that say things that they wouldn't say if they were getting up in Sunday school class. And they are much more valuable for that. And we also get their own voices. We have them saying these things. And as you know, women are largely underrepresented in Mormon history, so we do feel we are doing something to even that up.
I think that was what was so valuable about the autobiography you just published, that it covered a very unusual time period as far as records that I've personally been able to read.
Right.
I was reminded of Annie Clark Tanner's book that's been published, that basically the same sort of thing.
And how much more valuable it is in her words than it would be if O.C. Tanner wrote it, which would be a very worshipful piece because she was a wonderful person. But for her to really say how she felt about those things, you know, I cannot tell you how valuable these are to all of us. We just love them, the people that work on these. Just really.
Did you feel like you were sort of chasing your grandma around? I mean, because here as you said, there was a little bit more self-disclosure in this writing than there was in the public piece that she put together. But in the footnotes that you were put together, which are a really fun part of the book. You're also able to challenge a few claims that she makes, or perhaps see things from an external perspective and ask questions of her. Did you feel invasive at all when you were doing that, because she's a relative?
I did, but on the other hand, I think I have to do it. Now, when Richard does these things, he is much kinder to his subjects than I am. I'm tough on my people, but I felt, and I think grandmother would have been insulted to be challenged on some of these things, because she speaks in a very sure voice. But that is the major reason that I felt it was necessary to look at some of the contemporary documents and try and make clear why she had, what she was saying and what had actually happened. And I was very glad to have enough background information to be able to say that.
It really fleshed her out. That's the value of being able to find a primary source like that and then flesh it out a little bit to provide that background information. For the oral history project, are there any people, you said people were working on projects there, is it the same sort of thing where they're trying to annotate things or you know, follow stories, or what sort of work is being done with those?
So far they're mostly taking a subject and then finding information from several oral histories and then saying this one takes this stand and this takes the other stand and so on. But Richard keeps telling me, and I know it is true, that we are not even scratching the top surface of what we can do with these things, because they are primary documents. So I'm trying to think about, we're going to do this book, which will continue in this way of writing on a subject with lots of quotations. But this is not the end. We're going to do more, better, deeper, all those things.
Wider?
Yes.
Are you moving international? Are you looking at doing more work that way?
Absolutely. We've got already a group in Sweden. We've got a group in Australia. We've got various people that are maybe going to do things in various places. But it's a very hard job, you know. Every one of these is a big, big effort. You have to, you know, it's hours and hours, no matter what. It's hours and hours. Somebody has to type this whole thing and then edit it, look it over, and put it in various places. And so it's a lot of work, but it is work worth doing.
Have you found anything surprising out about Mormon women as you've gone through some of these oral histories?
Well, I've got all kinds of surprising things. As a matter of fact, I have a whole sheaf of things I could quote to you, and I could quote, I will just quote you a couple, and then I could do more. But as I say, they go on and on. I just don't know about these things. Let's see. I had this. This is my short one I really like. At the University of Utah, I lived with a widow who provided housing for four college girls. She was the sister-in-law of President David O. McKay. Once a month on a Sunday evening, she invited President McKay and his lovely wife to dinner, and many times we girls were included. I remember one time when we remarked on his beautiful hair, his beautiful white hair, and Sister McKay said, "I have to tell you a little secret, girls. I put bluing in his hair." President McKay said, "Now, Mother, we don't tell our little secrets." Now, that's a story that there is no reason you would ever hear, and yet that is perfectly characteristic of all the people involved, is it not?
Give us some more.
You want some more?
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm going to read you one long one at the end, but I'll... Okay, now this is... See, people talk about their perceptions of how they feel. I never felt I quite fit in at church. I began as an unmarried single woman, not married in the church, and at an age when most of my contemporaries were already married with children. I had no priesthood in my home. I didn't go to BYU. Even in my very early days in the church, I felt the difference. When I became the wife of a non-member, I was married but still without priesthood in the home. Then, along the way, I became the wife of the bishop. He joined the church, was made a bishop, from one end to the other. And then, the day he died, I became single with no priesthood in the home. That was such a shock. Within days after he died, I went from being the bishop's wife to being on the ministering visit list. Now, you see, that's a perception that men in the church don't have, that this is how these women are.
There's a new book that just came out this last year. It's co-authored by David Campbell, Notre Dame, and it's called American Grace. And it's an interview of people throughout the country focusing on how they view religion in America. And there's a section in there that talks about Mormonism and the priesthood. And the survey that they did, it wasn't comprehensive for the church at all. I believe there were only 100 respondents who were Mormon. But a good majority of the men, I think over 60%, would favor women holding the priesthood, but much less women. I think something as low as 10%. Why do you think there's that sort of a disparity?
Well, I think that women have been trained and socialized not to want the priesthood, and that they really do want their husbands to have it and to exercise it. Lots of women feel that their husbands are not using the priesthood as they should. So I think it's in the hope of living the ideal life as they see it that they oppose the idea of women having the priesthood. I'm of the feeling that that men do need the priesthood, that they, if they didn't have it, they'd stay home and watch the ball game. But, that's one of my justifications after the fact. You know, that's one of the things that women like me say.
We want to make sense of it, so, right?
Yeah, but mm-hmm. I think men would be happy to share it, or many would. I think that's why they don't particularly want the priesthood. I could probably find a pretty good quotation about the priesthood in here if I looked for it. As to changes in church organization, I remember the Sunday after the announcement of the extension of the priesthood to all worthy members. I went to PEC, that's Priesthood Executive Committee, and I was the only woman in that meeting. We were standing out in the hall waiting to go in, talking about the blacks and the priesthood. I said, "Well, brothers, you know what's next." I laughed. Some of them laughed. So, I think that's pretty good. Here's another one. My perception of women's role in the gospel is different from my perception of women's role in the church. In the gospel, I view the importance of a woman's role as equal to that of a man, 100%. It's that simple. Not so in the church. I still think we have cultural issues between men and women. I believe women take on more of a submissive role, consciously and unconsciously, in how they think of themselves, in how they interact with men. I think in the church, women are utilized for their organizational skills, for instance, for childbearing, for the growth of the church. We have a way to go for an equality standpoint, but again, I think it's a cultural issue and not a conflict with doctrine, which is a position that faithful women take when they have a bad experience. I'm going to read you this one more. This is more than you want. I don't have a lot of experience with priesthood in the home. In church leadership, I've known many great men, but overall, I've been disappointed. I don't think men live up to their priesthood responsibilities or potential. I don't think home teaching is taken seriously. I don't think women or the church in general are being served properly through the priesthood. The men I have known that I admire have loving and respectful relationships with their wives and treat women in general with respect. I've had situations where a leader was very unkind to me and showed great disrespect for who I was and the fact that I wasn't married, making insinuations that were not true about what was important to me. So overall, I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done to help men understand and grow into the priesthood. So you get comments like this, which you would not get from the pulpit.
Yeah, it's not going to come up in testimony meeting, I don't think. And if it did, it still would feel sort of strange.
That's right.
I think that's a good it's good to have an outlet for that. It's good to have a place to talk about, because clearly she feels deeply about that. And whether or not someone wants to go and argue against, you don't have it so bad, that's how she feels. And so it gives her an opportunity to express that.
That's right. And the men should hear it. So.
Yeah, if anything, it should encourage us to start doing our home teaching better, I guess, right?
Richard always does his home teaching better than anybody.
And what about visiting teaching?
I do mine.
Yeah?
I think it is an opportunity for us to make relationships that we wouldn't otherwise. So.
Do you go with the Ensign and read the whole thing, or do you go
and
chat?
No, I never do that. Yeah? I go talk.
Yeah.
I go talk, find shared interests, and see what we can do.
The last thing I want to ask you about is for people out there who are interested in doing their own oral history with family members. I'm going to be moving back east here in August, and I want to get together with my grandparents and talk to them. Mm-hmm. I was hoping you could give us some advice and some tips on how to put together something that way with our own relatives.
Well, I would love to see everybody do that. And if you want to have my little oral history manual, I'd be glad to send it to you and everybody. I have one that tells all about our project, has all of our forms, all of our the questions that we ask, everything you would need. And I can send you that. And I also have one which is very similar for somebody to do their own oral history. Or it is their oral history, but it's their written oral history. Tell their own story. So those I'd be glad to share with anybody. And I would also put them in touch with Lisa Clayton, who is now the head of the oral history program at Claremont. And we'd be happy to do anything we can to help you. Now, it's a big job. It's a big job. But it's one you'll never be sorry you did. Never, never, never. It's always, and it is possible to be too old to do an oral history will, and people do forget things when they get older, so it is worthwhile doing it immediately. You should do it sooner rather than later, and you know, that's right away. So anything that we can do to help, we'd be glad to know. You can put in any of our addresses.
Yeah, we can link that right on the website and give people the opportunity to check that out. That'd
okay.
be really great.
Excellent.
That's great. And one more thing, what's coming down the pipe for you next? What kind of projects have you got going?
Well, I'm going to be working on this oral history book. I'm also writing my autobiography, which is entitled I, Claudia. Richard gave me the title. He does all my titles. And then I've just got a few essays I have to get done for books. And then, oh, we've got an exciting thing coming up next spring. Richard and I are going to team teach a class on Mormon studies at Columbia. How about that? Because
wow.
There's quite a bit of interesting stuff going on about Mormons, you might have noticed.
Do they have any Mormon courses right now, or is that...
Not regularly. Occasionally they offer one. So
wow.
This will be a contemporary Mormon class. We'll see if we can get candidates to come and talk. We'll see if we can go see the Book of Mormon. We'll go visit the Harlem branch, Harlem ward, and other things of that kind. I think that will be quite an adventure.
What do you see in the rising generation of Mormon scholars? What sort of things are you excited to see in these up-and-comers?
Well, our students at Claremont were just sensational. They were the best students in the school. Everybody recognized that they were. And again, it's the old cooperation business. They know how to do things. They've learned how to do it. And smart and hardworking. It's just been very rewarding to me to see so many of the young students that Richard has worked with over the last 15 years or so now in positions of authority, taking over. You know, Patrick Mason, his replacement at Claremont, is one of his old summer seminar people. And, you know, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. And now the women are going to start coming along. We've got a bunch of them already, a few, but there'll be more. There'll be more.
Well, before we go, I was hoping there was one more piece of the oral history project that you could share with us, and we'll leave with that.
I'll read you a long one, but this is one from a woman who grew up in the Fiji Islands with her grandfather and a cousin.
About what year?
Well, she's alive now. She's in probably her 60s now, so I don't know when this was. But when I was a child and we lived in the village, we had no refrigeration. My granddad, when he had some money, he'd buy a loaf of bread, and we would sit on the floor on a piece of cloth. After we ate some bread, we would fold it up in the cloth and put it in a woven basket of pandanus leaves and hang it by a string to a beam of the home, off the floor and away from the ants. That is, if we had folded the bread up quick enough before the ants started to get in. Sometimes my cousin and I would run around and play and forget the bread. Later we would wrap it up and hang it, forgetting that the ants would have already gotten in. The next morning, Granddad would tell us to get the bread down. The kettle was boiled and the tea poured into the cups. And you cut the bread, and ants are just falling out of the bread. So I would get my piece of bread and, oh no, I would say, and I'd bang it on the floor and the ants would come out. My cousin and granddad ate their bread, but I am sitting there hitting the bread on the ground, and more ants came out. They would climb up my hands and legs, and I'd swipe them off and jump around. Granddad would say, "Just dip it in your tea." And I would say, "But it's still ants. It's going to kill me." And Granddad would say, "No, no, just dip it in your tea. It will kill the ants, and it will be all right for you. It's good for you. Trust me. See." And he would dip his bread in the tea and eat it and say, "See, I am still alive." So I would dip my bread in the tea and I'd eat it. But I would still want to pick the ants out. My granddad said that you could spend all day, but you can't get the ants out. When you pick at the bread, with every piece of ant you get out a piece of the bread. By the end of the day, you will have no bread to eat because every piece of bread that you pull out has a piece of ant on it. Then you will be hungry, no bread to eat. You will be late for school. I finally realized I had better dip it in the tea and eat it. He taught me that the ants are good for you. What Heavenly Father was trying to tell me was that my husband could be that piece of bread. And I pick out every little thing that is wrong with him, and at the end of the day there's nothing left of my husband to love, because I have picked out all of his imperfections. He drops his socks on the floor, his clothes, he doesn't wash the dishes. Every little thing that I think wrong about him would be like me picking the ants out of the bread. At the end of the day, there is nothing left of my husband to love anymore, because it is all eaten up by my picking at it. But when Granddad said to dunk it in the tea because it's good for you, well, if I take everything that I felt is wrong and that I feel bad about and take it to the Savior, and he immerses it in his blood and in his atonement, then everything would be all right. I could just take it to him and let it go and just immerse it in his blood and his atonement. Then it will be all right. And when Granddad said that the bread with the ants would be good for you, it really is good for me. It is better for me to let it go, or my days are wasted. That lesson hit me out of the blue, a powerful lesson about what the atonement means. The atonement must apply to me first. If I want the atonement to work in my husband, I need to work in me first. Heavenly Father can't forgive me if I can't forgive myself and others. So I try not to pick on the ants of others or of myself. How about that? Powerful theologizing from her own experience. Isn't that a wonderful story?
Thanks for sharing that. And this is just a few
bits and
glimpses.
Pieces. Just glimpses, that's right.
An overall project.
That's right.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that a lot. We really appreciate you joining us today on the FAIR podcast, Claudia.
It's a pleasure, Blair.